Okay, so I think we're all set. Thanks for being here. My name is Justin Gerhart. I'm from Austin, Texas, the Austin area. And today we're going to talk about unauthorized rabbis. So before we talk about Ecclesiastes, and we will talk about Ecclesiastes, I want to begin by sampling a bit of American media. Okay, so in 1965, Bob Dylan would release his album, Highway 61 Revisited. On this album, there would be a song that, despite its rocky start, would become a worldwide hit. It was a song about money and a song about the ephemeral nature of status, a song about cruel reversal of fortune. And Bob would call it, Bob, like, we're not on a first name basis, but Dylan would call it, he would call this song Like a Rolling Stone. And the song would go like this.
Once upon a time, it been so fine, through the bumps of time in your prime. Then you, people call, say beware, doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all kidding you.
Of course, the question.
How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home? Like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone.
Okay, so, by the way, this is not showing up real well. Is there like a combination of lighting that we could do, like pull another half of, or not another half, but half the lights down? That's a little, whoop, not that much. Okay. The other, was that different than the first thing you did?
Yeah,
that one. Okay. Okay. So what is Dylan saying here? Well, I think he's saying, among other things, that wealth cannot be counted on. He's saying that there are times, this being one of them, when people on top end up on the bottom. And often during those times, or almost every one of those times, they don't see it coming. He also is saying that innocence is fleeting and that life is harsh. He's not entirely upset in this particular case about this, presumably, woman's fall from where she had been, because the thorniness of the question doesn't seem like he's really interested compassionately in an answer. How do you feel? It's not exactly that kind of question, it seems to me. Though, you know, Bob and I haven't talked in a while. So, okay, so 1977, Kansas releases the song Dust in the Wind, okay? It bemoans the redundancy of life and the impermanence of our accomplishments as human beings, and concludes that we are essentially small pieces of dirt scattered in random, unproductive ways. And it goes like this.
Same old song, just a drop of water in the sea. All we do crumbles to the ground, though we refuse to see. Dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind.
So my parents became Christians, by the way, later in life, and I didn't grow up in we restrict a lot of media household. I mean, it wasn't crazy, but I remember distinctly my dad would not allow that song to be played in the house because I just think it was too bleak for him. No profanity or anything. He just couldn't handle the darkness of it all. Okay, so 1984, tracking through time a little bit, Bruce Springsteen gives the world an anti-anthem of sorts, commenting on the disconnect between sacrificing so much for one's country and then coming back home and finding no way to make a life within that country that you've sacrificed so much for. Bruce Springsteen calls this song Born in the USA. So this song is a happy one. After a run-in with the law, evidently the narrator, after that run-in with the law, finds an opportunity for redemption in being sent off to kill people of a different skin color, and after devoting himself to that end, returns then to his country of origin, only to find his service largely unrewarded. And his brother, by the way, who loved someone of the unapproved skin color, dies attempting to eradicate a people who end up, ironically, eradicating him. Not a lot of sense to be found in all of this. Not really a song, by the way, to fill moments with at baseball games, though that doesn't seem to stop us from using it that way. Okay, so 2007, Arcade Fire releases their debut studio album, and on it is a song that British music journalism magazine New Musical Express would rank as one of the top 25 songs of all time. In it, they sing about being paradoxically full of emptiness, and they will use these words. If there's anything, according to Arcade Fire, good, we humans are ruining it. Of that you can be sure. And that will never change, and so we might as well find some way to resign ourselves to this reality. One more. 2017, British virtual band Gorillaz releases a song they recorded with Mavis Staples called Let Me Out, and it goes like this. Look into my eyes, mama, tell me what you see. Tell me there's a chance for me to make it out the streets. Tell me that I won't die at the hands of the police. Promise me I will outlive my nephew and my niece. Promise me my pastor is a lion as he preach. Tell me that you're moving if there's lessons that I teach. Tell me there's a heaven in the sky where there is peace. But until then, I keep my peace in arms. Okay, so this is a song about the desire for a life that makes sense, right? The way you would think things should make sense. That a man will not die at the hands of sworn protectors. That those younger than him will, in fact, outlive him. That he will hear truth from a proclaimer of God's word. That there is something more and something better beyond this. However, we see that that desire is sort of undermined by this bleak skepticism and this suspicion that life makes that this life that he desires that makes sense in those ways is in fact not there to be found. And so, until then, he keeps his peace in arm's reach. And all of that, honestly, in my opinion, sounds a whole lot like Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes. Somebody want to read the first two verses of this book, by the way, for us? Out loud. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verses 1 and 2.
The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity.
Okay. Anybody have a different translation for vanity?
Meaningless.
Meaningless. Okay, so meaningless, meaningless, all is meaningless. By the way, during Bob Goff's talk, I thought, boy, what would it be like to hear Bob Goff read Ecclesiastes out loud? Talk about like cognitive dissonance, right? It just doesn't. I would love to hear it. Anyway, so the meaning of Ecclesiastes, right? Let's talk about that for just a second. Right there at the outset, as the people have discussions about who wrote it and how it's arranged and everything, but there at the outset, the narrator or the editor, whoever's talking, sort of lays out this abstract, almost like you're reading an article and you read the abstract before the article that sums it up. And verse 2 is a great summary. Meaningless, meaningless, everything is meaningless or vanity. And the word translated meaningless or translated vanity that appears again and again throughout this sad song is the word hebel, and that was just totally made up. I don't speak Hebrew, but I was just assuming that that's how that word sounds in Hebrew. But that's how it's transliterated. H-E-B-E-L, hebel. And that's the word that we see that gets translated variously depending on the point of usage and depending on the translation as meaningless or vanity. Half of the 64-ish times in Scripture this word is used appear right here in our text of Ecclesiastes. The word, according to Michael V. Fox, means literally vapor. Vapor, so mist, smoke, something like that. And that, the reason that there's discussion about what this word means in Ecclesiastes or any given context is the fact that it's sort of a metaphor. So you could translate it vapor, but it doesn't mean it's all vapor. He's saying something about vapor, something about this is like something about vapor, and we have to make that bridge ourselves. And that's where the discussion happens. And so various words are suggested as potential translations. So emptiness, nothingness, ephemerality, or worthlessness, or incomprehensibility, or just plain mystery. But as you roll through various options in terms of your translations of this word, they fall short. It's like some of them work in some of the uses, and then they just fall really short in other uses. Emptiness, for example, which, the old vanity of vanities, right? It just means, when that word was employed, empty. Yes, sometimes, that definitely goes with the vapor idea, but then also you find certain uses in Ecclesiastes where it seems like we're not just saying that this thing is empty, because empty just sounds like, I don't know, there's nothing to it. There's nothing to discuss. It's just empty in the end. It's a lot more neutral sounding and feeling than some of the things that Kohelet, which is the guy talking, just a transliteration of the Hebrew word used to describe him. Kohelet uses this word to describe some situations that really the best word to describe them is perhaps emotionally maddening. These aren't neutral realities. We're just saying, oh, it turns out there was nothing to that. Right? These are maddening realities that carry some really serious emotional weight. So complete futility, insubstantiality, transitoriness, they just don't seem to work well as definitions or translations of hebel or hebel. Like consistently in Ecclesiastes, even incomprehensibility seems to fall short. But I think with that one, we're getting closer. We're getting closer to an answer. I mentioned Michael V. Fox, and he's got a great book on Ecclesiastes. He says this. He says, Hebel for Kohelet means, and this is what he says, that word for Kohelet means absurd. Absurd. A possible synonym, though maybe not as strong as absurd, would be senseless. Senseless. And Fox makes a good enough case. I'm convinced that this is, in fact, what Qohelet is driving at. And so the message of Ecclesiastes then becomes simply life is absurd. Life is absurd. Now, let's define that word a little more precisely. Fox says the absurd is a disjunction. So it's like a separation, like one path, and then all of a sudden they're going in different ways. A disjunction between two phenomena that are thought to be linked by a bond of harmony or causality, or that should so be linked. Such bonds are the sine qua non, the essential part of rationality. This is how we make sense of the world. We make sense of the world by making sense of the world, right? The absurd, however, is irrational, an affront to reason, the human faculty that seeks and discovers order in the world around us. There are just some things in the world, in life, in your experience, and in mind, that when we try to plug them into our way of understanding, they just don't fit. They are senseless or absurd. Albert Camus, in his 1942 essay, The Myth of Sisyphus, points to the ubiquity of absurdity in the world. He says there are absurd, you name it, marriages, challenges, rancors, silences, wars, and even peace treaties. For each of them, the absurdity springs from a comparison. Like, I know this, and so you would think that this, but no. Right, and that's what happens. The absurd is essentially a divorce. So there's Camus pointing us to, I think, a good understanding of absurdity. If we say something is absurd in this way, we mean it's irrational. It's contradictory. It's difficult or impossible to reconcile, especially two things that just can't be reconciled. In philosophy, the absurd refers to the conflict specifically between the human tendency to seek inherent value and meaning in life and the human inability to find any. This is something that humans seem to bump up against again and again. And so accordingly, absurdism is a philosophical school of thought stating that the efforts of humanity to find inherent meaning will, spoiler alert, ultimately fail and are hence absurd in themselves. So when I read Ecclesiastes myself, I kind of feel like Qohelet, our author, is doing some things, right? So he's looking around the world that he inhabits. So he's looking at the scene, right? So this is like ground level, granular stuff. This is the stuff that he can see, the stuff that he hears, the stuff that he can taste and touch and experience, right? This is the stuff of Monday afternoons and Thursday mornings. And he looks at that, and that makes sense. I mean, it is what it is. Where he falls short then is in his attempt to like rise above that, right? So he's like, well, here's what is, but because I'm a human being, I have this sort of innate thirst to make sense of all of this, to draw things together, like, right? So there's no copy that we know of any document similar to Ecclesiastes written by a tiger. They're not asking those questions, right? This is a uniquely human thing. So there's something inside of you that's the same as what was inside of Qohelet to like rise above the observable and then make sense of what you see, right? So you zoom out, you get the drone view and you're like, oh, that's a lot closer to that than I thought. Or, oh, those roads go together and I didn't even know, right? You're looking for connections. That's what we do all the time. We make connections in our minds. This is how we make sense of the world, where he is up here and he can't make sense of it. Now, God's like way up here, and God's doing fine, right? God's not scratching his head. God's not wondering, where's all this going? Who's in charge here, right? God's not asking those questions either. So God's not asking those questions. Tigers and ants aren't asking those questions. Here's Kohelet answering those questions. He's cursed because he's high enough to wonder. But doggone it, he's just not high enough to figure it out. Right? So it's like it's all smooth up here on the sand on the shore. And it's all smooth out there in the water. But he's here in the surf. And it's rough in the surf. And you just get beat up. And he, in his quest to understand, just finds more stuff that he can't understand, and it drives him crazy. And I would imagine that he's got, I mean, we know this because he makes all these observations, right? You track with him. It's not like he's just like, listen, I've got it all figured out, except for this one context. Like, you know, the relationships between brothers and sisters, that just boggles my mind. You know, like money, fame, the rise of nations, you know, love, romantic relationships, you know, fortunes, trading hands. I get all of that. It's just this, it's like brothers and sisters born during these 3 years where he was like a firstborn and she was a third child. I just don't understand why those don't. He's not pointing to a narrow sliver of the human experience saying, that's what I don't get. You read Ecclesiastes, he's all over the place. He doesn't get any of it. Right? Not the way he wants to. Not the way he's trying, like on tiptoes, looking to make sense of things. He just can't seem to do it. And he just keeps finding things that he can't understand. Various contexts and parts of reality. That perhaps because, in the words of Michael Fox, life is saturated with absurdity. It is humanity's condition of existence. And I think, man, is that true? And then, after I live with this stuff for a while, and I start walking around here, I'm like, oh, it's true, right? The last 3 days, I found myself just a really fun guy to be around because it's like every 4 minutes, I'm like, well, there you go again, right? Nothing makes sense. It's all meaningless. It's all absurd. Like in the last, just if I think through the last 4, 5, 6, 7 hours, I needed something printed here on this college campus. It's a nice college too, with like lots of printers. And I'm telling you what?
Life is saturated with
senseless. Senseless. All this. I walked across campus being sent from one area to another area by one person who didn't know anything, to another person who couldn't do anything, to another person who didn't have. No, I'm like, I see one right there. It's like behind the counter. I'll email you, and then you just print it for me. I'll pay you $40. Nope. I felt like I was in the middle of a terribly depressing movie. And it's like, I'm just, oh, there it is again, right? I wake up in the morning. My friend Eric and my friend Ken are here with me. And Eric wakes up, he irons his shirt. I'm finishing up some stuff before we leave here for here. And he's standing there and he says, oh, hey, I'm not being rude or impatient trying to just like stand around because I'm waiting for you to go. It's like, I just can't sit down because my shirt will get wrinkled. And I'm like, there it is again. You wake up on time. You do your best to look like you got it pulled together. You iron your shirt. And then, because you were so pulled together, you got ready early. Now you can't even sit down because it will ruin everything. Like, what is this? Right? I'm in the surf and I'm getting beat up by the waves. I can't make sense of things. Things are not always as it would seem they should be. In fact, they're often not that way. And maybe, right, maybe that's why we see this idea popping up so often in the songs of these wayward minstrels, these unauthorized rabbis. All of those songs that we heard a second ago. It's like every one of them could be dropped into the text of Ecclesiastes and feel right at home. Right? I think if Bob Dylan and Kohelet sat down and had a drink together, they would have plenty to talk about. Don't you? In fact, we can imagine one of their conversations, perhaps. Right? Remember this? Once upon a time, you dressed so fine, threw the bums a dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall. You thought they were all kidding you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be without a home, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? And then there's Ecclesiastes chapter 5. There is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and he shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. It's like they could just sit around and round after round egg each other on. Of course, it's not just songwriters we find taking up the mantle of unauthorized rabbi. It's storytellers, too. For instance, our friend Albert Camus. He writes this book called The Stranger, and the protagonist in The Stranger is a guy named Mersault. And Mersault begins, like first-person narration, the book famously with this bizarrely matter-of-fact detached observation. He says, and I quote, "Today, mother died." Or maybe yesterday. I don't know. Maybe dude needs a planner. I don't, like, write stuff down, like journal stuff. This is stuff you'll want to remember later. So there's The Stranger, right? Then, of course, if we go way back, you got Sisyphus, right, which Camus makes use of many, many years later. The classic myth about the king of Corinth punished by being forced by the gods to roll an immense boulder up a hill, only to watch it come rolling back to hit him. And then he is to repeat this action again and again and again and again for eternity. Franz Kafka, definitely someone who seemed to be in touch with the absurd in life. There's so much absurdity in Kafka's writing, right? His Metamorphosis, great example. This man suddenly wakes up one morning, finds himself a giant cockroach, and the people around him barely even notice. And you read Kafka and you think, wow. And then you read his journal and you think, oh, this entry is from July 1920. Slept, awoke, miserable life. Maybe that's why Mersault didn't keep a journal, because it would just be full of stuff like that. Going further, right? Not just storytellers who tell stories through literature, but storytellers who tell stories through film and television, right? So we've got this show called The Walking Dead. It's a zombie show. By the way, anybody super concerned with spoilers? There's like one, two. Okay, you can leave for the next 3 minutes, and then join us again. It's a zombie show, right? So you've got the classic scenario: survivors and the infected, you know, at odds, and the survivors are just trying to keep surviving. But man, the characters in this show are constantly confronted with this maddening absurdity all around them. Rick, right, the arguable protagonist, wakes up at the beginning of the series in a hospital to find most people dead. So from the beginning of the show, Rick is alive only because Rick wasn't healthy, which is interesting. And then, of course, the fact that he's alive makes him worse off somehow than perhaps the people who are not alive. The show continues. We see the group, which kind of grows over time, sort of relentlessly itinerant, right? You always have to be on the run from zombies. This is how these things work. And but then you find solace, right? Finally, you can be free because of the protection that you find where? In a prison. Well, that's absurd, isn't it? Right? Walking Dead, by the way, right there in the name of the show, is itself an oxymoron that in this world infested with zombies, both seems impossible and undeniably true. You've got these social orders that sort of emerge among the survivors where laws must apply and yet exceptions abound, and really it's only by creating and be willing to accept exceptions to the laws that the laws really ever function in their intended way. You've got Rick himself. Rick is good or bad or good, right? It depends on how you judge. He is savior or he is destroyer. It depends on which episode you watch. Then you've got the community later on in the series called Terminus. And you get a new bad guy running that outpost. And in Terminus, there is order, like a lot of order. But in the midst of it, they've thrown aside the most basic laws of morality, like don't eat people. The best people on this show die. Dale, Lori, Herschel, Beth, and yes, doggone it, even Glenn. How did they take Glenn from me? It's like, I just can't make sense of it. It's all so absurd. People crave peace in this show, right? And yet return unceasingly to violence. And of course, over the course of the series, we are gradually confronted with the reality that it's not just the zombies, but in fact the protagonists who are the walking dead. Ecclesiastes chapter 4. And I thought the dead, who were already dead, more fortunate than the living who were still alive. But better than both is he who has not yet been and has not seen the evil deeds that are done under the sun. You remember this show? One of my favorites. A show littered with absurdity. I want to show a clip from one of my favorite episodes, an episode that haunted me from the time I was about 12 years old and I saw it first, called Time Enough at Last. This episode aired in 1959. It was adapted from a short story by Lynn Venable. And in it, Henry Bemis is the main character. He loves books, loves reading, but never has enough time to read. His wife's a nag, his job. And so at his job, he works at a bank. He sneaks down to get some alone time in the vault, the bank vault, from time to time, and has some really precious time alone down there with his precious books. Well, one time he goes down there and he hears a big boom. He comes back up to find the world destroyed in an atomic blast. All right? He's confused. Then he's a little excited to be alone. And then he just is completely in despair. And we meet him with a gun in his hand.
Of chickens. Sir George Bernard Shaw. Poems by Browning, Shelley, Keats. Great dramas of the world. Books, books, all the books I'll need. All the books I'll ever want.
thing of all is there's time now. There's all the time I need and all the time I want. Time, time, time. Ah, there's time enough at last. That's not fair. That's not fair at all. There was time now. There was all the time I needed. That's not fair. That's not fair.
Our friend Kohelet, I have seen another evil under the sun. And it weighs heavily on mankind. God gives some people wealth, possessions, and honor so that they lack nothing their hearts desire, but God does not grant them the ability to enjoy them. Life is absurd. That is a loud and clear message in Ecclesiastes. And I think we should appreciate that. But then also we should acknowledge that the message of Ecclesiastes does not stop there. I think the full message of Ecclesiastes is this. Life is absurd, but it can and should be enjoyed. Life is absurd, but it can and should be enjoyed. In the end, I think Ecclesiastes is not a message of nihilism, nor is it one of disengagement. Kohelet may sound like Camus' Meursault at times, but he isn't a Meursault. He still feels that being present in life is worth something and that there are ways of conducting yourself here that are good and ways that are not. There are moments when the sweetness of life is undeniable, right? Chapter 11, verse 7, light is sweet and it is pleasant for the eyes to see the sun. I think Ecclesiastes is by no means a manifesto of unbelief. A lot of stuff in life doesn't make sense. And that stinks. But, you know what? Work anyway, says Kohelet. Love anyway. Feast anyway. Because you don't have to understand everything to enjoy something. And that, I think, is the more comprehensive message of Ecclesiastes. So, with the couple minutes that we have left, let me ask this question. So, what? So these wayward minstrels are preaching the message of Ecclesiastes. So that's the message. What does that mean? Why does it matter? What do these echoes of this text outside in these unexpected places show us? What should we do in light of this as Christians or as ministers? Let me just offer three suggestions. Number one, we should embrace Ecclesiastes as a bridge between the chapel and the world, between the believer and the unbeliever. There are moments, right? And we better know this. There are moments when irreligious people bump up against truth. Capital T. Truth. In those moments, we should embrace their discovery and humbly avail ourselves of their perspective because they may have something to teach us. This is the world we live in, right? I think, what do we take away from this? Well, let's acknowledge that and let's say enough with the platitudes and the saccharine naivete. We sometimes pander in church world. Things are not often as we would have them to be. And an awareness of this, and yes, even a dissatisfaction with this, is, I would say, not incongruent with faith. And a faith that makes sense in the midst of horrors like Auschwitz. And in the redundancy of doing dishes again. And in the prosperous gloss of godless Wall Street. A faith that is sophisticated enough to endure the contradictions and vexations of the human experience. It's that faith that often stands as the most effective witness to a world full of people wrestling with the absurdity of life under the sun. Navigating and embracing even such diverse spiritual rhythms, I think, helps to engender a robust salvation. Secondly, we should allow both Ecclesiastes and modern Kohelets to remind us we are not God, and it's okay that that's a pain in the neck. We are not God, and it's okay that that's a pain in the neck. We're not God, right? He outranks us. We know that, and we forget that all the time. And while there are many instances in which the truth of, say, Isaiah 55, 8 and 9, right? My ways are not like your ways. God's ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts, etc., etc. While there are times when the truth of that is a welcome blessing, let's be honest, there are also many instances in which that same truth is an irksome affliction. What I like about Ecclesiastes is that it is honest. It comes at the end of much reflection, yes, but it still reads like a live feed rather than something someone cautiously edited. I think Ecclesiastes is an unresolved chord that is the perfect chord for the moment. It acknowledges that there are times when God's wisdom is not emotionally satisfying, times when his plan isn't intellectually satisfying. Ecclesiastes shows me that it is possible to maintain faith in the midst of skepticism and disapproval, that God not playing by rules that make sense to me is not a reason to stiff-arm him. Maybe this intersects with that spiritual rhythms idea. A life of faith has movements that are a bit discordant and syncopated. Lastly, I think a takeaway for us is this: we should act in light of the fact that these absurdist stories are being written on the hearts of our churches. We better realize that. And what do we do in light of that? Well, again, for one, we acknowledge absurdity. And that is to our credit when we do. And it is to our credibility when we do, right? We have to acknowledge the strangeness of life, which is in part acknowledging that to a large extent the strangeness of life is the strangeness of the experience given to us by God himself. Sometimes you just want to talk about how stuff feels, and tying up the loose ends all the time is unsatisfying because it doesn't ring true with our experience, right? All the loose ends aren't tied up all the time for you. Why do we try to tie them up for all of our people in our churches? It makes me think of May of 2013, a few years back. We had this crazy week in the world, and specifically in our part of the world. For me, where I preach, we had a week of tornadoes not far away that killed people, bombings, like a real bad series of bombings in the Middle East, terrible developments in the war in Syria, and then, to cap it all off, a heroin overdose by one of our members' sons. And I had something planned for that Sunday, but it just didn't seem to make sense anymore, because nothing did. And so what did we do? Did we close our eyes and pretend that everything was okay? We try to figure out how to tie up the loose ends, or better, just pretend that none of that stuff had happened or that this wasn't the place to talk about it. No, in that instance, I feel like we got it right because we just took a Sunday for lament. And I led our people in saying out loud together the words, "God, things are bad. God, things are bad," right? When tornadoes ravage a town in Oklahoma and children are buried under the wreckage, "God, things are bad." When a wave of bombings in the Middle East kills more than 70 people, we say, "God, things are bad." When war tears Syria apart and at that time. Tens of thousands die, and we are reminded that there is nothing casual about the casualties of war. We say, God, things are bad. And when conflict presses down and the timbers of a marriage splinter and creak, we say, God, things are bad. And when one of our own families rushes their son to ICU and loses him hours later, we say together and unapologetically, God, things are bad. We say that because we're looking, because our eyes are open. We find ourselves again and again in this liminal zone, having been given a thirst for justice and an appreciation of order and beauty and a rational mind, all that echo the divine, but then having been given this perspective that falls far short of God's vantage point. And so often we find ourselves craving this grand order that we are unable to discern. This is real. Denying it doesn't do God any favors, nor does it do honest searchers any favors. And so I would say we need to help cultivate in our people a more comprehensive outlook, a faith that's sophisticated enough to make sense in varying contexts. And I'll say this and then we'll be done. I think it's worth saying that given our vastly superior vantage point, living in a post-incarnation, post-indwelling reality, millennia after Qohelet, having access to the fullness of scriptural revelation and awareness of Christ's first fruits resurrection and the encouragement of a spirit-filled church, the very body of Jesus who said in no uncertain terms, I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also. Given all of that, and the difference that we bring to this search with all of that, that Qohelet did not have, shouldn't we be able to pop our heads a bit further above the clouds every once in a while and enjoy a point of view that is inherently more comprehensive and inevitably a bit more hopeful than that of Qohelet? I think the answer is yes. I do not think, despite its value and its truth, that the book of Ecclesiastes gives us license to become spiritual curmudgeons. I think the way of Christ calls us to more than that, and the hope we have in Christ enables more than that in us. Thanks for coming.